All right, one syllable. Okay, so I thought in the spirit of Partha's talk and some of the discussion that related to that, that I would give the following talk, which actually fit with the title Scott gave, which is Bridging Single Neuron Measurements and Network Function. But particularly, I thought I would try to tie in to, and it's not usually my style to try to rile people up, but I figured in the spirit of this workshop that I maybe start with this picture, which is that obviously connectomics is a very hot field right now of interest to many, if not most of us. And it occurs on many different scales. You have people who are doing various versions of track tracing, and all the way down to the serial EM, trying to reconstruct at electron microscopy scales entire columns of cortex, and ideally stitch it together and have an entire brain at that level of resolution. There's all sorts of neat techniques like the Brainbow technique, which labels sort of randomly labels different neurons different colors and certainly help with the image segmentation part of the computational problem. But I think there's already been some debate. I think yesterday there was a nice back and forth about how much insight will there be? And if you listen to some people, connectomics, once we have the wiring diagram, that's going to be the panacea. That's going to solve all of our problems. I mean, I think that you have to take that with a bit of a grain of salt. But then you have other people who say, for goodness sakes, we're deluding ourselves. Yes, we'll have a lot of data, but okay, that's nice. We're going to be as stuck as we were. So I wanted to give a concrete example of something where we've been working on a problem, trying to tease apart a network. And you'll actually be able to see nicely sort of what we gained from the anatomy that we knew, which was quite crude, certainly not at the level that of the modern techniques, and not remotely close to the level of even what Kathy's done, because we haven't been able to do that sort of anatomy. But you'll see what we've learned, and then where we've gone horribly awry on theories that we thought might be right just from that anatomy. And that's where I think there's a nice lesson. So, any complex behavior, obviously one of the ultimate challenges of neuroscience is there's people who study all the way from individual molecules, whether it be ion channels or signaling pathways, all the way up to behavior. And that's that is one of the intimidating challenges of neuroscience. So the problem I'll talk about is trying to tease apart a circuit that I'll show you a little bit about. Basically from data occurring on the cellular level and some responses to input currents, so we know something of the cells here. Then some work, we know some crude anatomy, some gross anatomy of the structure, and we can do some further functional anatomy through lesion studies. And this is not my work, so I'm the theorist on this. This is work from David Tank's lab and Emery Oxey, his former postdoc at Cornell, and then all the way connecting this up to behavior. So punchline will be how computational modeling can connect these, but the punchline for this group is going to be what do we learn, what were we right about from our naive picture that originated with just looking at the connectivity, the gross connectivity. So the problem I'll be talking to you about is looking at the eye movement system. So there's a motor control circuit, and I'm going to just look at one little itsy-bitsy part where we actually think we know what the function is, so now we can start asking about circuitry, and that's sort of another thing that's a rare case in neuroscience where you actually can say what the function is. But let me just show you the behavior that we're going to tie this all into. So I'll be talking about eye movement systems from multiple vertebrate animals, but most of the data I'll show you is from actually goldfish eye movements. And to a decent approximation, goldfish eye movements are similar to any other vertebrate animal's eye movements. Okay, so now we're zooming in, and what you see here is the goldfish eye as the head is fixed and the animal is scanning around its environment. Most of the movements are horizontal, and I'm only going to focus on the horizontal eye movement, so you'll find that. And the thing that you should notice here is there's a characteristic pattern. You don't see smooth eye movements. Instead, what you see is that the eyes move with these rapid movements between different fixation points. So I will refer to those rapid eye movements as saccades, and in between when the eyes are fixated, those are called eye fixations. So anyway, there's been a long history of studying this system. So the circuitry is fairly well understood, at least at the later stages. And what I'm actually showing you here is from a goldfish. This is on the bottom, an eye position trace. So what you see is fixation, saccade, fixation, and so on. So this is the behavior. And we've known for a long time that there are a couple populations of neurons which command these saccades. Basically, I'll show you actually some real traces, but you can think of them as eye velocity commands. They are saying, I would like to move my eyes at a certain velocity. There's two populations, one of which commands to the left movements, one of which commands to the right movements. I'm going to focus only on the horizontal eye movement system. Turns out there are also vertical movements of your eyes and torsional ones. Thankfully, the horizontal eye movement system is largely decoupled from the vertical and horizontal control. Those are controlled in a different brain area, combined much later. So it's a nice system where we have one degree of freedom that we can talk about, and we can sort of focus on the neural circuitry and worry less about very interesting but more complex issues of complex motor control and coordination. So very early on, it was realized that, gee, people had found these eye velocity command neurons. People knew that ultimately motor neurons had to control spring-like muscles, which means they needed a eye position command. They needed to basically hold the tension on the muscle, Hooke's law, the force that needed to come out of the motor, ultimately from the motor neurons, needed to be proportional to the displacement. So somewhere there needed to be an integral in the system, something that converted a velocity command to a position command on the motor neurons. I'm not showing you the motor neurons, but there you can think of them as a readout. And what was found several years later was that there were indeed neurons in a distinct nucleus, which was known as the oculomotor eye movement neural integrator. And this is actually showing a recording from David Tank's lab. First author in the study was Emery Oxey. And what you can see is that there are sometimes little transients where you can actually see the effect, that there was a brief burst of input, we say, coming from the eye velocity command. But during the fixations, what you see is these neurons maintain stable activity, and that stable activity has a level which is proportional to the eye position. So during fixations, we say that these neurons carry the eye position command. And I'll actually show you a movie of a recording of one of these. By the way, there's connections of this to some of the work that Albert likely talked to you about. People like myself use this as well as a nice model system for short-term memory, because, of course, the key feature of memory is that in the absence of a stimulus, you maintain a representation in memory. In this case, the stimulus would be the transient eye velocity command. In the absence of that stimulus, these neurons maintain a memory of the running total of all the velocity commands. So maintaining that running total is just holding that in memory. And for those who are interested in more cognitive work, there's a lot of connections of integrators appear all over the psychology literature in decision-making problems, because people have this view of decision-making that you accumulate or integrate evidence, and then when you reach a certain bound, you make a decision. And people like Mike Shadlin have actually found neurons which integrate the evidence of in a particular task where there's an where there's a motion velocity signal, and basically that's integrated, and animals need to say, basically, was that motion velocity in a certain direction or in another direction? It's another talk. Okay, so just going through some of the physiology, it's nice to set that up. So this is just showing another clip. This is actually just showing you that this occurs across species. So this was from, I think they pulled this one from a cat literature. So this is showing the eyes. Again, here's a fixation, there's a saccade, there's a fixation. And this is showing the firing rate, that is the number of action potentials per unit time during this eye fixation. So this is one of these neurons that is for eye movements in one particular direction, but you'll notice not for the other direction. That's basically the way to code the two different axes, is just to have a positive movement set of neurons and a negative movement set of neurons. And if you just blow this up, what you see is this is the firing rate of this neuron and this is the eye velocity. So this is why people say that these bursting or rapid trains of action potentials that come out encode the eye velocity. Okay, so now we look one synapse downstream from that. Where do these project? They project to these integrator neurons. And now I'm going to show you a movie from David Tank's lab. What you're going to see is the firing rate of this neuron as a function of eye position. And you're going to see this linear relationship here between firing rate and eye position during the fixations. You'll be able to see when the burst commands came in, and that there'll be deviations from this. At the same time, what I'm showing you here is actually a movie of the eye moving back and forth. So you'll see two representations of eye position. And you'll hear the crackling you hear. The crackling is individual action potentials being recorded. So you'll hear the higher frequency when the firing rate is higher. So there you could see the saccadic burst come in. There, again, that's the input. But notice that during the fixation, the neuron's firing rate is held quite stable, corresponding to holding the eye position quite stable. This is just one of many neurons, of course. Yep, so these are spontaneous eye movements. I'm going to stop the movie. It goes for a little while. So these are just spontaneous eye movements. I should make a really strong point. It's believed that this is done in a feed-forward manner in the dark. So in other words, you can keep a nice stable signal if the lights are on, because basically the animals would be able to see when their eyes are slipping and not keeping their eyes held in one position. But when you turn the lights off, people have looked to see whether there's any sort of feedback control back to these areas, and it doesn't look that way. So you can do things like tug on the eye muscles and see if there's a response in these integrator neurons to see if there were any proprioceptive signals. You don't see evidence for that. So we believe from a host of experiments that this is really a feed-forward transformation performing this integral. And that's really nice, because now we really know what the circuit does. Now we want to ask, how does it do that? And this is where we get back to the anatomy and what we thought we knew the answer almost just from the anatomy. Okay, so here is a layout of a sort of a summary of the physiology and anatomy of this circuit. So what I am showing you here is not just one neuron, but many neurons. I'll refer to these as tuning curves. That is plots of the firing rate versus eye position. So what you saw basically in action was one of these for one neuron. In fact, in the goldfish, there's a very nice feature of the anatomy that on the right side, basically, there's a large number of neurons. Each of them have a very close to linear increase of firing rate during the fixations as a function of eye position. Different neurons have different thresholds at which they begin recruiting. That is, as the eyes make fixations in steps from left to right, certain neurons won't turn on until a certain eye position, and then the rate at which they increase will be different. Left side neurons you can think of as statistically mirror images. Here I think I literally just took a mirror image of the neurons, but they're not identical, but basically statistically there's no difference between left and right. But the nice thing is that the left side neurons, their firing rates decrease linearly as the eyes move from left to right. Okay, so like I said, that's the organization of the circuit in terms of the response of neurons on the right and the left. What else do we know? Well, from a host of previous experiments that I'm summarizing here, four neuron populations. On each side of the midline of the brain, there are excitatory populations, so this is representing a whole population of neurons, inhibitory populations, and there's a very specific connectivity, and that's what you should notice here. The excitatory neurons, they send their projections on the same side of the midline, so notice that excitation is, we say, ipsilateral, same side of the midline. Inhibition is always crossing the midline. So that's the basic. So this is the identified circuit. We could get into details of exactly where there might be subtleties where we could argue, but there's been, you know, this is sort of summarizing many years of anatomy and physiology. So this clean separation here, so the area of the brain that would be in the mammal would be the nucleus propositus hypoglossi. Possibly, and this is where people get into arguments, possibly neighboring areas of the medial vestibular nucleus, and that's what's still a little hazy. In the goldfish, it's actually much cleaner. It's a distinct nucleus, and you don't have these boundary issues. People have named it with the exciting name Area 1. So in Area 1, it's a distinct nucleus, and the nice thing about that in the goldfish is that there's a clean separation between the right side neurons having positive slopes, the left side neurons having negative slopes. In the mammal, there is a asymmetry between the number of neurons, but if you looked on the right side, you'd also find populations of neurons with the opposite slope, and we don't know what the difference is there. But so the mammal gets more confusing, and that's part of the reason people like David Tank and my colleague Bob Baker have worked in the goldfish, because it's a really clean system and it makes it much more amenable to trying to tease apart the circuit. Yep. But there are subtleties. So that's actually a really interesting point. So mammals, these areas are estimated to be about 2,000 neurons. or a couple thousand goldfish, about 100 neurons total. That may have something to do with the fact that goldfish aren't foveated, so their need to have very, very precise maintenance of their eye movements may not be the same as a foveated animal where you really want very, very tight control. What it means in terms of practical modeling is we can build a model which is almost literally the circuit, because 100 neurons, that's fine. You know, you can run a 100 neuron circuit on our computers. So I will build a model which is representative of the entire circuit and make some concrete predictions and also test out some predictions from the theory. So what I want to pick up on here is this picture alone, this anatomical picture alone, we thought told us how the circuit worked. And it was partly right and partly horribly wrong. And that's going to be one of the punchlines of the talk. So here was the basic story, and there's one more experiment. So the one more experiment is we know that injecting current into single neurons, so this is just a very cartoonish picture, but if you inject current into a single neuron, it doesn't appear to have this memory. When I say the memory, again, I mean that a very transient psychotic burst leads to this persistent firing, which keeps the running total of the velocity to convert to position. So basically, single neurons, their activity basically will decay on some intrinsic time constant, but not the tens of seconds of memory period. And if you actually do look at the animals, their eyes aren't perfectly stable. They tend to go back to a central position, but with a time constant of about 20 seconds. So orders of magnitude longer than the typical timescales we think of as synapses. Synapses we think maybe NMDA, for those who are familiar, maybe the slowest time constant. There are different varieties of the NMDA channel, but you usually don't get more than a couple hundred milliseconds out of that. So there's an interesting issue of timescales here, and we can come back to that. But the punchline, you know, looking at these data and looking at this architecture, it was proposed from very, very early on, work of David Robinson in the biomedical engineering department at Johns Hopkins, and he said, well, look at this circuit. This is exactly what you would want to be able to convert a transient input to a sustained output or perform an integral. What you have is, okay, so the single elements may not store memories, but we have this recurrent excitation, and that's a positive feedback loop. So with that, you put a transient input in, it would decay away if there weren't any positive feedback, but then basically activity can reverberate around this loop and be maintained through positive feedback. But he actually preferred and sort of focused on what he thought was the more prominent and more important positive feedback loop, which is a double negative form, which is that each side inhibits the other. That is, when these neurons are excited, they disynaptically inhibit these neurons, which were inhibiting them. So that's a double negative form of positive feedback loop. And he sort of had some various more just purely theoretical arguments for why he thought that these were the important mediators of the positive feedback. So already we have this setup that we have the circuitry, and it looks exactly like what you'd want to create this persistent activity and do this integration. You can very quickly write down a linear model, which is what David Robinson did, and basically show that there's an eigenmode, which is a perfect integral of its inputs. It's just very simple linear response theory, or just linear network theory. So what I want to show you is that indeed something about this was right. There is positive feedback, but that actually, despite this anatomical architecture which really suggested very strongly these two positive feedback loops, that it's going to turn out that the recurrent excitatory one was true, and that was actually the one that the field kind of didn't emphasize so much, but this recurrent disinhibitory one, which was so clearly suggested as a double negative form of positive feedback loop, was actually wrong. And I should mention one thing that I haven't shown you here, that there are background inputs. So one thing you might think is, okay, wait one second, if we're just going to have a double negative, then there's still got to be, if we got rid of the excitation, which they often did in those models where they emphasize the inhibition, there's got to be something to make the cell fire. Well, these neurons also receive a very large background level of input. So you can think, when the eyes are moving pointed straight ahead, these neurons are firing at 40, 50 hertz. And it's thought that that's basically one of the ways the nervous system keeps track of positive and negative numbers. There's sort of two ways to do it. I think Mitya mentioned one. Sometimes you have and the burst neurons do one. You have one population of neurons which fires for positive and another population which fires for negative, and those two you staple them together and you have your two axes. The other way the trick the nervous system does for negative numbers is it just has high background firing rates, and then it can go up and down from those and therefore code positive and negative. This system does more the go up and down from a background. Okay, so that's the basic background. So where do we come in now? Well, we already had theories which came just from the basic anatomy. Now the question is, can we go and test those by combining what we know from not just anatomy, but lots of neurophysiology, and start bringing in the whole set of data? So the big picture of what I'm going to take you through, and again, I made this a quite short talk, so feel free to interrupt, and I think I sort of left some time at the end that we could maybe have discussions about what you can learn and what the program has to be, because I think that's the interesting one. Following slides is just going to show you a process of fitting a model by doing what Partha said can sometimes be really problematic, which is to a certain extent curve fitting. But what we're going to fit a model where we have a cost function and a certain set of constraints. So some things are hard constraints and some are the cost function. But basically, we want to build a model which meets the following key experimental results. First, we're going to take as a hard constraint the gross anatomical organization of excitation and inhibition. Excitation only projects to the same side of the circuit, inhibition only projects to the other side of the circuit. We basically say any connection weights that don't obey that get hard constraint to zero. So part two, we actually have single neuron experiments where that always means my experimental colleagues, have injected current into these cells and have looked at their single intrinsic neuronal responses. Then I showed you the data for we have a whole database of single neuron firing rates during eye fixations. We think we have a good statistical sampling of what the different neurons look like here. And then the key final experiment is we can look at how the neuron breaks when we inactivate the circuit in different ways, when we basically remove different portions of the circuit. So the program is going to be first, I'll just show you quickly a fit of a spiking model of single neuron responses. So the first thing we're going to do is just get a good model of the single neurons, and then we're going to ask questions about what could the connectivities be between these neurons. And the connectivities, just to be a little more clear about this, there's two features of a connectivity. One, there's sort of a global how strong does cell A connect to cell B. But the second thing that people often ignore, especially when people are trying to do simplified neural networks, is that those can be non-linear. So basically, for a given maximum strength, as the presynaptic neuron goes to more and more elevated firing rates, how does the postsynaptic response follow that? Is it saturating? Is it something where there's a threshold for it to begin responding? And likewise. So that those are the types of parameters we're going to try to look at. And basically, more work on the what can we rule out than necessarily find the final answer. Because I'm not going to find a final answer, but I am going to rule out a bunch of things and hopefully make some very strong experimental predictions for types of networks which work and can be tested experimentally. Okay, so first data, and this is the one I referred to, showing that single neurons don't have memory. So the first thing that Emery Oxide did was he did an intracellular current injection into a particular neuron. So this is showing injected current as a function of time. It's a very simple, slow ramping up of the current and then slow ramping down. This is actually from the data, but I've just made it into a simple form where I'm indicating here the time. Every bar here is representing the time of an individual action potential, and that's one way of picturing it. Sometimes it's nicer to picture that as just looking at the firing rate as a function of the injected current, and this is number of action potentials per unit time, and you can see ascending versus descending, they largely overlap, so there's not huge amounts of hysteresis. And again, what this cell looks like to first order is it's basically following the injected current. When the injected current is ramped up, the neuron's firing rate goes up. When the injected current goes down, the firing rate goes down. This is not a single neuron which intrinsically is holding on memory to the stimulus. Okay, so the single neuron doesn't have memory. So what did we do? Well, we went and we just built a simple what's called a compartmental model, basically a model with a few key ion channel, so for those who are into this, a leak channel, a sodium channel, and two types of potassium channels, one the classic Hodgkin-Huxley one just so it could generate action potentials, and then a second one which was transient and which we had to fit the parameters of to basically get the input-output relationship of this neuron. That potassium channel that we fit, it was sort of nice. It happens to look like one of quite similar to one of the prominent ones in there, but you should take that with a grain of salt. Mostly what we were trying to get is a decent single neuron model so that we could put that into our network and use it to build upon to say things about the network connectivity. How many parameters were there in this? So there could be as many parameters. The question is, how many did we actually vary? Yeah, so we played with the amplitude, with the overall density of channels of each of these, so that would be 4, and then we played with one key parameter of relating to the kinetics of this particular channel, so it was 5, and I can show, here is actually going to show you what we did, but to fit it, if you care. There were 5 of which some of them were more important than, some of them were more important. There was one we could actually throw away and it really wasn't sensitive to. Yep. Where are you going? Yep. So the key thing that we wanted to capture, and that was actually key to the experimental design, we really wanted this model to capture the slow dynamics of the response, because what we want to fit is the persistent, is basically those tuning curves, the persistent activity when there's stable firing at different levels, and we want to basically have the and or sometimes there's very slow, we also often do paradigms where there's very slow drive, slowly moving the firing rates of these cells. So we basically wanted these cells to respond to slow variations of current like the real cells. So I would not trust this model to go and fit if you did some set of current injection with very high frequencies, probably this model would be horribly awry. But this model was really just supposed to capture the slow responses, and that was the point, and that's what we fit. So here, we can get back, but let me just show you. So what this is actually showing is the model's responses. These were the data spikes. We injected the exact same current into the model, and you can see the model basically spike for spike, even when you blow it up, is reproducing the data. This is better than this is better of a fit than the variability from cell to cell, but we basically took some typical cells to fit this too. And we did a very, and for those interested in the algorithm for the fitting, fitting point processes can be a tricky problem. For this case, we actually did something which worked very well, and I'm not sure it's the greatest fitting technique out there, but basically what we did is we took the cumulative spike train, which is now approximately a smooth function, and that's shown right here, and then because it's a nice smooth function, it was very easy to use. Choose your favorite smooth function fitting routine. I can't even remember at this stage which one we use, but basically we fit that the model parameters to reproduce that smooth function, and as you can see when you go back to the individual spikes, they line up almost one after the other. But the real punchline is we just wanted it to fit to slow variations of currents, and it's not necessarily going to fit to other regimes, and a future project is going to be to try to get better single neuron models, absolutely. Yeah, smooth in quotes, right, stepwise, very small steps, but yes. Yeah, and I want to say that actually he fit, if I recall correctly, Dmitri actually fit 4, so I think he may have held the leak current fixed from some other time constant data of the cell, so I think he may have pulled that one from an independent experiment, and then I think he did a 4 parameter fit, so.
Depending on your curve is, if you make 4 parameters, almost guaranteed you're
Yeah. Well, so I mean, you could get away with one parameter if we just wanted to come up with an arbitrary parameter. I suppose we could have. We at least wanted to tie it to biophysical, you know, some biophysical model, underlying model. But I'm not sure this matters in terms of it just having the right input-output relationship. Yep. We did not make, and so Dimitri would be the one who could best tell you this. Certainly, there is some there is some work from Eve Marder's lab, which was actually my work, showing how there are many trade-offs between many different sets of ionic conductances, which can all lead to virtually the same firing pattern, and that this even happens in biology, so that we're not even sure whether it even makes sense to say that this neuron is a given set of conductances. So basically, this was part of the work that I did as a side project of my PhD thesis, and basically, just to summarize a long story, they had this very puzzling data where they had identified cells in an invertebrate animal, which were all supposed to be seemingly functionally carbon copies of each other, and they were finding that the actual parameters that went in front of these, the channel densities, varied by factors of 2 to 4, each of them individually. So what I did is, coming from physics, I said, oh, well, let's just make a phase diagram, because I bet, or a state diagram, a parameter, you know, plot the activity of cells as a function of the parameters. And what you found that was that there were lots of, basically, that these were not independent, that the different types of ion channels were not truly independent. You know, in very detail, if you looked at every nook and cranny, yes, there'd be little differences between the models, but to get the basic underlying patterns of firing, there were lots of trade-offs between them, and there were certain combinations which could basically cancel each other, and then certain combinations of these parameters that would robustly drive them. And the real punchline out of it was, we should think differently about cells. We shouldn't think of trying to find the exact set of parameters for that cell, because actually what the data were telling us was that different cells would achieve biologically the same, quote unquote, good enough activity pattern from quite different sets of parameters, probably through some negative feedback. Basically, when the activity went awry, then there'd be negative feedback, but then channels actually are constantly inserted and removed from the membrane channel. That's like there's a random walk. So these channels are random walking in their densities all the time, with feedback trying to keep them in the right place. So you expect that the directions that they random walk that don't cause changes in the activity, basically there's going to be a lot of those can really diffuse and cause a huge amount of random walking. It's really changed the way I think about how carefully I want the exact set of parameters, because I don't even think the cells really have that exact set of parameters. It's a different talk, but it's an interesting one, and it relates to some negative feedback and thinking of it. It relates a lot to negative feedback and robustness, and this is exactly the work John was talking about in his talk. Exactly. So we can't. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So there's two. I mean, so this one in the transient potassium channel was really important. No. The second type of potassium channel was really critical. No, sorry. There is a leak current, which could be a potassium or a chloride channel. There's the sodium channel, that's the spike generating one. There's the delayed rectifier potassium channel, that's the other half of the spike generating one. And then there's a transient potassium channel. Transient just means it has an inactivation. It both activates and inactivates. That is separate, that is should not be thought of as leak. Leak is a model where it's passive and not voltage dependent on the conductance. This other one was voltage dependent. Yes. Yes. So yes, so Dimitri did, and that was why he actually started with 6 that he was playing with, and as they sort of chipped away, he found that there were 4 that were sort of key, that basically when he started going down, he said, oh, I don't really have to play with, I'm trying to remember, now that you mention it, I think it's the sodium one he found he didn't have to play with, and I talked to him and I said, isn't that just because you need enough sodium to be able to generate the spike and then it doesn't matter? And he said, yes, that's why I didn't play with the sodium one. So he basically put enough sodium in that you could get a spike, and then the sodium one became completely irrelevant. And then the other ones, he did find that there were four that were left that would really make you not fit this curve unless you adjusted them. And he used the algorithm. The one that I always think of it as an amoeba because it's constant, it's the simplex algorithm. He used the simplex algorithm and he seeded it all over the parameter space just to see how many different sites there might be, it might, you know, converge to. And he only is, at least from my conversations as I recall, this was actually done quite a while ago, he only found one optimum when he seeded it all over the place. Was he going through dramatic efforts to try to do that? No, at some point we really wanted to just take this and put it into the network and move on. Yeah. Exactly. So let me move on. Good. Okay, so next set of data, and we're going to get into some of these issues again potentially. Okay, so what I showed you was a movie, and I showed you one neuron, and let me just show you how they were parameterized. And you saw the movie, but basically the individual neurons, they were parameterized with two of the following three parameters. Basically, they were all found to be quite threshold linear, so you can characterize them by each of these points on these graphs is representing the sustained firing rate when the eyes are at a particular eye position, so these are during the fixations, and then you can characterize them by their slope, k, and their eye position threshold, e threshold, and or if you wish to work with the firing rate at zero, so look at the y-intercepts, you could also characterize them by that. So basically, this is now showing you a summary of the entire database we have. So we have a whole database of these neurons, and this is showing you actually this is now the model's interpretation of this database, but what this is about half of these neurons tuning curves actually are real recorded tuning curves data, basically their slopes and thresholds, and then the other half we just plotted out the distribution of slopes and thresholds, and once we had that distribution we just randomly sampled until we got up to 100 neurons. So our database doesn't have 100 neurons. We wanted to run the same number of neurons that there are in the network. We don't know of any difference statistically between the excitatory and the inhibitory neurons. There could turn out to be differences, we don't know, but this is showing now in the model, these are all of the tuning curves in the model, right, left, inhibitory, excitatory, and we think this is at least probably a pretty good sense of the distribution of what you might see in one animal altogether. Okay, so what we wanted to do was build a model which would reproduce all of these tuning curves, which would basically integrate its inputs and have the tuning curves of each of the neurons in the model reproduce all of these tuning curves and have the input-output relationship to at least to slow inputs of the single neurons. So how do we do that? Well, it's actually pretty nice. So the first thing we did is we took that single neuron model where there was a triangle wave which was injected into it, and since we wanted to look at persistent fixations, we ran that model and we put a constant level of current injection in at different levels from 0 to 0.8 nanoamps and measure the firing rate in the model. And that's what's actually shown here in the dashed line. And then I'm not going to get into it, but we also wanted to capture some of the noise properties, so we injected noise just to match the coefficient of variation of the spiking, and that's actually the gray line is sort of showing the input-output relationship in the presence of noise that matched the coefficient of variation of the cells. So we have that, which says how the single neurons respond to injected current, and then we have the tuning curve of the neuron, the firing rate versus eye position. You put those two together, and the nice thing is that this gives you the current required to produce the observed firing rate at any given eye position. So now we know how much current had to go into the soma of each cell when the eyes were being maintained at a particular eye position F is the function relating current injection, constant current injection, to firing rate. So you just take the inverse of that to get the current required to produce the observed firing rate. So where does that current come from? Well, that current comes from the other cells in the network plus the background inputs. So that's the basic model. So it comes in through synapses. So we then said, okay, we need to model the synapses. And what we did was we actually first assumed a certain form for the excitatory synapse, a certain form for the inhibitory synapses. And then what we're going to do is just do a brute force search over a couple dimensional parameterization of these synaptic nonlinearities. We distinctly keep excitation and inhibition separate because there's no reason that excitatory synapses have to look like inhibitory synapses. For simplicity and to reduce down the parameter space, we take all the excitatory synapses to be the same and all the inhibitory synapses to be the same. We've played with that. Some of it is, it's not just blindly doing this. You get an idea what you're doing as you're doing this, so you kind of, half of this is, it's like semi-analytic. So the basic equation is that the postsynaptic current sent into a cell from a presynaptic neuron is a weight W times a function of the presynaptic input S, and that's called the synaptic activation. That's what I'm showing you here. It goes from 0 to 1, and what I'm showing, so what you could take like this excitatory one, you see the sigmoidal form. So what this would be is as the presynaptic neuron increases its firing rate, basically the postsynaptic cell doesn't activate very much, doesn't activate, and then around 20 hertz of presynaptic firing, it starts to activate quite sharply. For those who are into synaptic physiology, we thought that this might be a model of something like an NMDA synapse. NMDA is this special receptor that not only needs transmitter to open, but also needs the postsynaptic dendrite to have reached a certain voltage to pop out magnesium ion that's been blocking the channel. So basically, if the presynaptic firing were not that strong, you could imagine that that magnesium block wouldn't have been popped out because you didn't get enough depolarization of the postsynaptic dendrite, and then once it's removed, then the synaptic activation would go up dramatically, and then there's saturation. At some point, you can only bring up the voltage to the reversal potential of that dendrite. So everyone has saturation at some point. The question is whether it's in the physiological range. So the bottom line is we pulled these out of sort of a generalized version of sigmoids where you can move the midpoint and the width of the sigmoid. So if you made the sigmoid wide enough, it could basically be a linear synapse. If you move the midpoint of activation outside of the physiological range, it's a superlinear synapse. If you move the midpoint way over to the left, and we always normalize it so it went down to zero, then you had a saturating synapse. So it was a clever two-parameter parameterization that we could search over. Okay, so that's basically the synapses, and then we put it all together. We now say we needed to know the current required to produce the observed firing rate, and we took that from data, basically just combining the single cell data and the tuning curve data, and that's going to come from a sum of recurrent excitatory current, recurrent I mean by other cells in the circuit, recurrent inhibitory current, and then constant background currents that are coming from outside the circuit and are just constant level and not changing. Okay, so for the model of that, we just said that the total excitatory current actually converging on the soma, here's where we made a simplification. We just said it was a linear sum with synaptic weights wij, that is the strength of the connection from cell J to cell I, times some nonlinear function, that's the synaptic activation function of the presynaptic neuron's firing rate. That models the total amount of excitation. This models the total amount of inhibition, and then there's the constant background current. The beauty of this formalism is once you look at this, you realize that this becomes just a simple regression problem. Basically, once we choose a particular form for the synaptic activation function, so S's are known, now these are known. Remember, the rates are all known. That's from our database of tuning curves of all the neurons that have been recorded. This F comes from the single neuron firing properties. So the unknowns are the weights here and that constant background current. And those are just coefficients in a nice, basically a constrained linear regression. So you can fit this, and you can fit it super quickly, and you can then brute force your way through whole sets of different parameters here, because each of the fits being a regression converges like that.
So you're saying in your circuit, conduction delays don't play a role?
So there are transduction delays, but when you're modeling persistent activity on the 10-second time scale, we don't believe that the transduction delays are of a couple milliseconds matter. Now, there are spike timing dependent theories that certainly, you know, one can come up with more, I'd say in this one people would consider it more exotic theories, but So the other thing to know is that the eye plant is a low pass filter of several hundred milliseconds. So at the end of this, you're going to have a several hundred millisecond low pass filter coming out of this. But we're talking really about the yeah. So. So one could be concerned about this. In this network, first of all, there's some very simple features, which is every loop through the circuit is a positive feedback loop, because of the fact that it's all basically, if you go from any neuron and try to get back to yourself, you go through either excitatory connections or an even number of inhibitory connections. So that structure actually makes it such that everything is positive. Basically, everything is a positive feedback connection, and you don't tend to have some of the problems that you would get with oscillations and the like that you would get in more balanced networks where you have inhibition and excitation in a much more mixed up architecture. And we believe that's some of the reason you don't have so many of these issues. You can go and play with putting delays in, it just doesn't matter. And part of it is, one of the punchlines is going to be that we think those synaptic connections are very slow and are also low pass filtering. And again, if you're trying to build 10 seconds of persistent activity, it makes sense to build these things on slower intrinsic elements. That's going to be one of the punchlines, is everyone tried to look at this problem and said, the network is so smart and we don't see anything in the somatic response that looks like it's slow. We think that, at least in order to fit some of the data that I'll show you in a moment, it really looks like probably something out in the dendrite or at the synapse is pretty slow and is probably low-pass filtering to the point that it doesn't it may not care about spikes. I do have some theories of where spikes could matter, but the behavior is that fixations are held with a very slow decay on the tens of seconds time scale. So that is the behavior we're fitting. There's an interesting question about how do you do that rapid, how do you do the rapid change? And there's a couple answers. First, there's a pathway which skips this circuit entirely and goes straight to the motor neurons, and that's to help produce that initial kick. And then this comes in and holds the activity thereafter. And part of it is, and that is a problem that I think about all the time, which is a very subtle point, and you brought it up, that you brought up, which is how are you, on the one hand, very slow, yet on the other hand, can change relatively rapidly. One answer could be you slam pretty strong inputs in, and you probably do put pretty strong inputs in. We can talk about it. I have some theories that I think there are some non-linearities in the response that accentuate these brief, that know that there's something special about these brief burst input commands and do something non-linearly responding to those. Yep. I will come.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly can tell us the dangers of making conclusions. What I think it can tell you is that when you look at a circuit and you say, ah, here's the network I needed to, you know, here are these mutually inhibitory, here's this double inhibitory loop, there's your positive feedback loop. That's something you concluded from the anatomy, and it was dangerous. Yep, so I will come back to that. I actually think the network and the cells share. I think the cells get you 1 second, and then the network adds the next order of magnitude. And that comes directly out of, so basically, I published a model of this sort because on theoretical grounds. So I'm switching from my usual theoretical models to this is the most data-driven project I've ever done. And part of the reason is I wanted to go back to the data and see what the data told us before I built my next generation of models, which were just getting, they were on these same issues you were of, okay, fine-tuning's a bad thing, so I'll, you know, put in something which cures the fine-tuning, but do I know if I'm right? And then we'll see how it comes around. And this was the key experiment. This is what really, I think, starts unsticking us. So I'm going to first focus on the network aspects of it, and then we can come back to this intrinsic aspect of it. So here was the key experiment. So basically, you could go and do the fit that I just did. And it turns out, you know, sort of an answer to your question about the single cells, there were a huge number of networks that could, basically a huge number of connectivities and a huge number of synaptic nonlinearities that could fit, reproduce all of those tuning curves beautifully and be beautiful integrators. So there were things which didn't work, and that was nice. We could rule some things out, but there were just a huge number of classes of circuit architecture within that gross anatomy that could work. So these were the experiments that really started lowering down the possibilities. So these experiments are really beautiful. They take advantage of the anatomical organization of the circuit. And what Emery Oxey did here was he recorded from a neuron on the right side of the circuit while inactivating the left side of the circuit. What was beautiful about this is now, because of the organization of the circuit, he could remove the inhibitory input to this cell because inhibition comes from the other side. So when he did that, this is actually showing a recording of one of the cells. And what you see is that, first, the thing that you would have expected, there needed to be some, in order to have the persistent activity, there needed to be some balancing between the inhibition and the excitation to hold that required amount of current. Now you've removed inhibition, so you've upset that balance. And what happens when you remove inhibition? Well, the firing rates start drifting upwards. That's not surprising. What was surprising was that actually that only happened when the neurons were at their lower firing rates. It really turned out that this happened when I defined low firing rates. It was when the eyes were directed one way or the other way. So low was relative to their quote unquote background rate, the rate that they produced when the eyes were just in the central looking straight ahead position. When the rates were high, the activity remained stable, despite the fact that inhibition had just been removed. And this suggested, and this is what sort of we put into the model, this suggested that maybe there was some effective threshold that basically when these neurons were at their high firing rates, remember this, when one side goes up, the other side goes down, when these neurons are at their high firing rates, these neurons are at their low firing rates. So somehow it looked like these neurons, when they're at their low firing rates, those low firing rates certainly are not necessary to maintain the persistence on this side. Looks like there's a functional threshold in there. Part two was doing sort of the complementary experiment. Again, record from a right side neuron, and now inactivate a portion of the same side, thereby removing direct excitation onto this neuron. And you found the complementary result. Now, losing excitation, you found downward drift in the firing rates, but only when the neurons were at high firing rates. When the neurons were at low firing rates, their firing rates remained stable. And I'm not showing the summary data. The summary data is quite clean on this. So again, that would be at the times when the other neighboring neurons were at low firing rates. Basically, their loss didn't affect this circuit. Okay, so how do you model that? Well, the simplest way of modeling that is to start with the removing inhibition. So removing inhibition, removing one side, what we found was that the neurons that were on the recorded side, the spared side, maintained their high firing rates. That is, maintained their firing rates when the eyes were to the appropriate side of the central eye position. So what it looks like is that these high firing rates can be maintained without inhibition. So we required the model to be able to maintain this fitting equation without the use of the inhibitory term for this range of firing rates. And then for this range of firing rates, there are actually two possibilities. One, these low firing rates could be maintained without the use of excitation. That was what we found. When we removed excitation, they maintained their low firing rates. But there was a, but this one we had to be careful on, because you couldn't entirely remove all excitation, because you're recording neurons on the same side. So what he's doing is he's recording a neuron here, he's inactivating here. So there are really two possibilities. One, basically, every neuron's like every other neuron, and removing excitation is it's the same. It doesn't matter that he removed neurons that were far away versus close together. But it's possible that the activity was maintained here because there was local connectivity, and the more local parts, and basically the feedback coming into the cell was from the nearby neurons. So we left that possibility as well. So that's what this means, and or possibly by very local excitation. So what we did is we basically put into our model in our cost functions based on basically each of these criteria. I told you sort of main. So one possibility was, well, for this one it was cleaner that these had to be maintained without inhibition. These had to be maintained by excitation without inhibition, and these ones either had to be maintained by inhibition only, and or possibly we put a constraint on only allowing local connections to maintain the activity. And when you do this, is just sort of showing you what one of these fits look like. The dashed line is the dashed line here. That's the current required to maintain a particular eye position. And red here is showing you the total across all of the excitatory neurons, the total excitatory current into this neuron, the total inhibitory current into this neuron, the total just background current going into this neuron, and then the sum total of all of those currents, you know, when the circuit was well tuned, matches. And what you'd find is, under certain assumptions, if you chose certain forms of nonlinearities on the synapses, then you absolutely just you couldn't get all of the experiments to fit. And in fact, the most prominent hypothesis had assumed a saturating synaptic function, and that one absolutely didn't work. And it wasn't because, and at the time it was proposed, we didn't have the inactivation experiments. It fit the regular data fine. As soon as you asked it to fit the inactivation experiments, it didn't work. And you could say, and it turns out you could say that for all previous models out there. Basically, once we put in these inactivation experiments, none of the previous models in the literature worked. Yeah. Yeah, and that was, I mean, and that was where I basically, like I said, I had put out my, you know, my favorite theory on how this circuit worked, and I finally said, I think we have enough data now that we can set up the framework where we can try to systematically, at least, if not find the answer, at least start ruling out the previous theories by combining across all these different experiments. And that was the goal of this project, was just to step back to the experiments. I don't think, theoretically, this is, you know, as interesting as some of the other work, but I think it's closer to the truth. Okay, so this is just showing you that it works. So this is showing you that it integrates inputs. We didn't pick a particular set of inputs. This is, we put in arbitrary patterns of saccadic inputs, and this is just showing you one of the arbitrary pairs of saccadic inputs. So what's shown here in green is actually a perfect integral of the saccadic pattern that we put in that I'm not showing you. And then what's shown in gray is actually the firing rate. This is in particular for one particular neuron, and gray is actually the firing rate of that neuron. Like I said, we put noise in to try to model the actual level of noise. So in black, what I'm showing you is what any experimentalist would do, which is to go and filter that noisy firing rate, trace it so you can see what the heck's going on. And what you see is basically that this neuron in a noisy manner is perfectly integrating the input. What's shown on the right here is sort of the reverse of what you're probably used to seeing. So the lines here are actually just showing you for four of the experimental neurons from the database what their firing rate versus eye position relationships were. And now in the box plots are actually the responses of the model neurons in the circuit, and the box plots are doing the 25th and 75th percentile of their firing rates, just to show you sort of the noise in the model. And I'm not showing you the noise around the experimental traces, and we didn't try to find detail getting that exactly right. But what you see is up to noise, basically every single neuron is matching the tuning curve. So at least we have a model where every single neuron in the model matches the tuning curve of a recorded neuron from the database. So that's what's shown here. And then you can look at the inactivation experiments, and you want to see that those match as well. So this was the experiment where on the left, where we removed where Emory removed inhibition, and you had the drift upward of the firing rates due to loss of inhibition at low rates, but not at high rates. And this is just showing you the model does the same thing. It drifts at low rates, but it's stable at high rates. And then this is showing removing excitation, and that you basically have drift downward at high rates, but not at low rates, and that's showing you here. I think I actually this isn't the best example for showing this. This is a neuron which hardly had where you hardly can see the low firing rates being maintained stably. But trust me, and it does the right pattern in all the neurons. Okay. Yep. Yes. Or it's, again, some of these, the truth of the matter is they have not labeled for the transmitter on these neurons. It is believed, I'm trying to think, in the vertebrate preparations they may have, except the vertebrate preparations are trickier. They just call the two ones class 1 and class 2 depending on the direction of the slope of their tuning curve, but they're mixed up in terms of which side of the midline they are. So we believe that the excitatory neurons do not project across the midline. We don't have a direct, and this is where I said there are some subtleties, we don't have a direct, like, what we want, and I think what Emory is working on, is getting sort of an anatomical fill with a transmitter label on it as well, so you would know that it was truly an inhibitory neuron always projecting across the midline. But it's possible that it's not the case, and I've actually thought about some theories where maybe the anatomy wasn't quite right and what that could do, but this seems to be consistent. This seems to be the self-consistent one, but I can't say it's 100%, and like I said, I have waiting in the wings some theories if it turns out not to be right, but those are low odds theories, so.
So, like,
yep. So those tuning curves definitely include inhibitory neurons, and Emory does not know when he records from a neuron extracellularly. He just is recording from a neuron. He doesn't know whether it's inhibitory or excitatory. In a very small number of very, very painful experiments, he has filled a neuron afterwards and then, you know, traced it and look where it traces to. I asked him whether he, from the very small sample, could see any difference between the excitatory and the inhibitory ones, and he said no. Very small sample size, that could be the reason. There could very well be very different thing. There could be differences between the excitatory and inhibitory ones. So if you wish, at this stage, I'm sort of modeling what's known, and there are possible things that aren't known that could be lurking. And likely will be, you know, when we figure it all out. The ones that are at lower rates don't affect the system. Inactivating, yes, for those. Let me say something about the inhibitory ones. So what is compelling about the fact that we believe that those ones which cross the midline are inhibition and not, and probably not excitation, is what they actually do is they cross the midline, they send out collaterals, and then they go to the motor nuclei, where it's almost certainly where they go and command the eye movement muscles that are corresponding to the ones you would want to inhibit for the eye movement. So it's the exact same one that goes to the down to the motor neurons that is strongly, strongly, strongly believed to inhibit the motor neurons that's sending off collaterals. So you would think, so that's why people think it would be really weird to send an excitatory neuron to that motor the motor neuron pool with the wrong sign. So it would be really, really weird. But they don't have the transmitter label. So anyway, but it would be really, really, really weird to be the wrong way there. So I should have been almost stronger about the indirect but compelling sense. Okay, so let me just put this all together, and this is where we're going to start getting at some of the punchlines. First of all, what comes out of this? Well, there are many different networks which work, but they classify into three, you can either call them classes, or maybe I like to think of them as sort of, when I say class, I'm really thinking sort of mechanism for maintaining the persistent activity. And it all relates to that sort of threshold, that the low rates don't seem to be really, basically, when you remove the neurons at the times they would have been firing at low rates, it doesn't affect the persistent activity, and that suggests that there's some sort of threshold process. And the first class of models, when we sorted through all the different models that worked, there was a synaptic threshold, a soft synaptic threshold. So that is to say, the synaptic activation function was like that one that I emphasized at the beginning, where basically there's very little activation until the presynaptic neuron reaches some more elevated firing rate. So that's why the low firing rates aren't doing much, because they're not doing much at the synapse. This would be characteristic of NMDA type synapses, which are known from a lot of work, pharmacological work, to be exceptionally prominent in this brain area. So that seemed like it might be saying something that could be right. When you actually looked at the weight matrices, so basically what I'm showing you is the connection matrix here, presynaptic neurons labeled from 1 to 100, left side 1 to 50, right side 51 to 100, then organized 1 through 25 are excitatory, that's the connections are shown in red, 26 through 50 blue for inhibitory, and then furthermore I organized the left side ones as the eyes move from left. Basically, as the eyes move from one side to the other, the first ones to recruit are labeled more leftward. The next ones, so these are what we call the lower threshold ones, and on the right are the higher threshold ones. The last ones to recruit as the eyes move from one side to the other. So here, there's nothing very special about the connectivity. This is sort of your modeler's, this is sort of the biological version of your modeler's all-to-all connectivity. Yep. You should not worry about that. And in fact, there's one little control experiment here, which is that basically, because we're fitting one neuron at a time and it's self-consistent, each of these four blocks, the only difference on those four blocks is that we've got randomness in the different pools of neurons. And basically the same fitting algorithm ran on this block, this block. And that's, so any differences between any of the four blue or any of the four red blocks is because the tuning curves were slightly different, and the fitting algorithm picked up on the randomness. And so what we did, so what turns out to be important when you look at these, it turns out that it's very important that you have the connections from the higher threshold neurons. If you remove those and try to fit, it absolutely is a disaster and can't fit. If you remove the low threshold ones, this one is the opposite. If you remove the low threshold ones, it absolutely can't fit. The higher threshold ones, the fits, they're not that sensitive. So we've done sensitivity analyses. There's little bit, there's, on any individual fit, there's little bits, but that's where, within the class, there's more variability within the class than across what you're seeing, and that's what you're really getting at, I think. So we very much focus on sort of what's robust and what's not robust, and actually we're submitting it. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So, The most important here one here is this, and it turns out the other thing that's most important here is that there is some amount of strong connections from the lower threshold neurons. Yep, and that's going to be the opposite of class 2. So class 2 don't have these synaptic thresholds. I picked one of the most linear ones here just for illustration purposes. But what you see here is they use a different threshold. Basically, again, the neurons had different thresholds. What you see is this network wired up so that the low threshold neurons, that's the early ones in each group, so you can see it here, here, and you can also see on the right side, they're not connected. That's what this white means. So, and what that basically is saying is they achieve their threshold by only using the higher threshold neurons rather than putting the threshold at the synapse. So that's theme 2. And then theme 3, mechanism 3, really only applies to excitation. It was because of this experiment that there could be local connectivity. So you also can get within the excitatory neurons. And here I was actually, what we did is we actually assigned each neuron a topographic location. And what you see is this is basically where you removed excitation, but the reason these neurons remained persistent was they mostly were dominated by local connections around them, and that's what you can see is that these dark diagonals says that there's a concentration of the connections for local connectivity. So basically, strong local connections, and that was a third theme. And then inhibition in this case still follows one of the other two themes, class 1 or class 2. Okay, so this is great. This is where I think that connectomics, I do want Kathy or Partha or someone to go and do the connectomics, because I want to know, for example, basic questions like, is this local connectivity there? I mean, that's a pretty basic question where I really just want to know the anatomy. So there are definitely things that I would like to know about the anatomy, and I think really answer a lot of questions. Here's one of the things that I think is very important. I think it's important both in thinking about sort of the fine scale connectomics, and I think it's very important in thinking about things like functional connectivity that we do when we model whole brain type models. And this is now showing the difference between anatomical and functional connectivity in the circuit. And the key is that there's some key nonlinearities, both the threshold nonlinearity for the neurons and then the nonlinearities at the synapse. So what I'm showing you here is just what I showed you on the last slide. This is the anatomical or structural connectivity. For the three different classes, different classes of circuits. Now I'm going to show you the functional, or if I were in the MRI world, I would have used the word effective connectivity, because functional really means typically in cross-correlation, and this is more how much current is going from one cell to another. So what I'll be plotting you is similar plots. Each dot here now represents the current going from one cell to another, normalized by the presynaptic firing rate. So if you wish, this is like the functional synaptic weight. It's the current per spike coming out. And when the eyes are to the left, it's a response function. It's like kind of like doing, if you're used to biophysics, it's like a cord conductance, where you normalize. So the word functional connectivity I used because I didn't think the target audience of this was necessarily going to be the MRI world. Functional connectivity usually means cross correlations. If you go and look at Olaf Sporn's notation, he would have called this effective connectivity. But let's be rigorous. Exactly what I mean here is that when you see a color here, and sorry, I removed the exact strengths, which probably aren't that important. The color here represents the amount of current going from neuron, let's say, 1 to neuron 1 divided by the presynaptic firing rate of that neuron. So basically, I look at the amount of current going from one to another, and then I normalize by the presynaptic firing rate, because that's just the naive one. Of course, if the presynaptic neuron fires more, you're going to get more current. So I scale that out, and that's my functional or effective connectivity. And that is what I mean.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And that is part of the point here, and maybe I'm preaching in your case to the faithful, but this one really illustrates how strongly you can go awry by thinking that you should expect them to be the same, because it's going to change the whole interpretation of how the circuit works. Okay. Yeah, this is submitted, and we actually made a point about the difference between calling it functional and calling it effective connectivity in there to try to be clear for that crowd, but we didn't think of it as response function, but it's not finally through, so we can definitely go back and work on that. But anyway, let's just get to the punchline. So when the eyes were to the left, what I want you to notice is basically these are the left side neurons. They are driving the circuit. So the left side neurons are driving, excitatory ones are driving both the left and right side of the circuit. The left side inhibitory, those are driving. So basically the left side neurons, they are driving the circuit. On the other hand, the right side neurons, they are functionally disconnected. So you see, it is silent. It is disconnected here, disconnected there. And then for class 3, it's a little different. The inhibition is actually still there, but again, for the inhibition, functionally disconnected. And that's why, so basically, the inhibition one in dash gray here, that is functionally basically close to zero, and then I use a different notation. The excitation, depending on which class of circuits you're in, is either not there or it might be there if you're in class 3. Then if the eyes are to the right, it's the opposite story. Now basically, the right side neurons are the drivers, and the left side neurons are functionally silent. So this is very, very different from the picture here where everything's connected to everything. Functionally, whichever the side the eyes are to, that side is driving the circuit, and the other side, they're followers, but they're not sending back out. This one? Yep, this one. So this is in Eve Martyr's terminology, this is called good enough. This turns out to be something which, if you go and look at the fixations, they're not quite perfect in this model, but they're as good as the biology. And the reason they're not quite perfect is because we have a criterion which says it needs to be close, it needs to be, basically, this is actually a mistake in the wiring, but it's a mistake which causes such a small effect on the behavior that we, in this assay, basically ruled out things that were worse than the behavior, but left in things that were... Mm-hmm. It was consistent with the animal. And I think that's a more subtle point that's really important, that we used a biological criterion. We didn't say this had to be your mathematician's perfect integrator. The criterion was had to be as good as the animal. Yep. You have to take my word for it. Sorry. Don't have it with me. Okay, so the implications. Well, so what I just said to you is if you take the eye network activity, for example, when the eyes are directed rightward, basically the right side neurons, those are driving. So this loop is active, and that's the positive feedback loop due to recurrent excitation, which can maintain this persistent activity. On the other hand, due to the thresholds, the right side is sending inhibitory input to the left side, but the left side is below threshold in terms of its functional connectivity, and it's not sending input back. So you've broken the loop. So you do not have this, even though anatomically you have a disinhibitory loop or a mutually inhibitory loop, functionally, you do not. Basically, inhibition is either going from the right side to the left side, or if the animal moves its eyes the other way, then inhibition is going from the left to the right, but those two are not functionally active simultaneously, therefore there's no loop. Therefore, the original theory that said that the key positive feedback loop was mutual inhibition is incorrect. The key positive feedback loop is recurrent excitation. Excitation, not inhibition, maintains the persistent activity. Partha, getting back to your question, the one other thing is to fit the time scale of the drift on the inactivation studies, you needed to assume that within this excitatory loop, that these synapses had about a 1 second time constant. So there's something intrinsic as well. Yep. Yeah, and I'll on the next slide I'll give you my hypothesis, which fits with the pharmacology but is still a hypothesis.
So given the way you have isolated the circuit, yep. There's no way it would ever stabilize itself with inhibition, which is completely
we may need to discuss this later. I'm not sure. So if I leave out the cost function terms related to the inactivation experiments, you can build perfectly good circuits where basically the mutually inhibitory loop is contributing to the positive feedback. Again, the key thing is that, again, it's mutual inhibition on top of there being some background excitation so that you can both go up and go down. Otherwise you would have the problem that you go below threshold and then nothing comes back. But the key thing is that these neurons have this really high baseline firing, and that's why that loop was potentially going to be relevant, but turns out not to be. Okay, so inhibition, again, this is, I think, the dangers of making too many conclusions from anatomy without laying on top of it the physiology, is that inhibition is anatomically recurrent. It led to all sorts of theories based on that. But when you lay on top of it the physiology, it's functionally feed-forward. And that's about as dramatic as I could come up with for an example of being wrong from the from the naive guess of what's going on from the anatomy. And I do think this is very relevant to anyone who looks at functional connectivity based on correlations and things like that with MRI, or just looks at anatomy. So these groups of neurons we think are specialized for eye movements within this same area of the brain. And that's what's actually made this so hard, that we can't just go do the anatomy. So you'd like these to be the only neurons in that area of the brain. They're not. Within the same area of the brain, you have all sorts of neurons that in the fish are responsive to things like tail movements. That's not entirely surprising. When you move your tail, you're going to move your head a particular way, which means you're going to want to move your eyes a certain way to keep moving. But within this, so these neurons were selected by looking for neurons which had eye movement related responses, but there are other neurons in that area that we don't know what they're doing. The obvious one is you see if the fish flicks its tail, you see these other neurons start responding. Oh, I yeah. So there are other classes of neurons which have position-related responses, which anatomically look like they go to the cerebellum, which is related to sort of learning of the motor control. One question which this may relate to, and tell me if I'm missing your question: what the heck is the inhibition good for? Yeah, so what it's good for is keeping the two sides coordinated. So in an earlier publication in 2007 in Nature Neuroscience, I showed an illustration where I basically, in the model, put a midline section. I basically took a knife and slit down the midline. And what you see is that the two sides start random walking apart from each other. So what inhibition here does is it coordinates, but it doesn't do the... but it isn't responsible for the integration. And let me just put my final sort of summary of these results, and then I'll tell you why I think it left inhibition for coordination, but depended on excitation for the integration, because I think there's a reason. I usually am much more conservative, but in the spirit of this meeting, I'll tell you what my hypothesis is. Okay, so anyway, the model fitting, I was just showing you how we fit persistent activity and used a cost function to try to simultaneously enforce many different experiments at different levels of organization of the nervous system and generate some predictions for what synaptic nonlinearities and connectivity, certainly ones that don't work, and give some classes of ones which do work. Excitation, not inhibition, maintains the persistent activity. And at least that first class suggests, it suggests the presence of various threshold processes, but I want to latch onto that first process where there's a threshold in the synapse. And that looks like something which was in these previous theoretical works. I think Xiaojing Wang probably did some of the first work on this idea of bistability. Then people like Alex Kulikov and John Listman and myself have proposed that particularly at excitatory synapses, there can be positive feedback within an excitatory synapse, basically where excitation coming in through the synapse leads the voltage of the local dendrite to go up, which then leads either the synaptic channel to stay open, which would be the NMDA thing, or other neighboring channels to stay open and leave the voltage up, and basically leave the voltage up for the time scale of a second. And I think that may be the 1 second time constant that we needed to fit the rate of drift. And that is something that you wouldn't see at inhibitory synapses, but you would see at excitatory synapses. So if you have excitatory synapses which are slow, inhibitory synapses which are fast, and you want to build something which maintains good, slow, robust behavior, build the positive feedback loops on your slow intrinsic elements, not on your fast intrinsic elements. So I think that may be one of the keys. The other really interesting one is that what we basically said was the low rates didn't seem to be below a threshold and getting cut off. When you actually go and look at the CV of these cells firing, they're not like cortical neurons. They're much more clock-like and regular. But at low rates, they're actually reasonably noisy. And at the high rates, they're quite regular and clock-like. So I think the other thing this system may know is that its low rates are noisier and its high rates are less noisy, so it wants to do its computation on the less noisy high rates and truncate and threshold out the low rates. So I think between those two things, that may tell you why it's using excitation and getting rid of its low firing rates. So that's my theory of sort of why it's doing this. And this is the end, so, you know.
Yeah.
So that's your first order picture, except that if you went and did that, you would end up with noisier than this. So these aren't a good. Putting the Poisson process and a refractory period in probably would still end up noisier than these cells. I mean, the CV at the higher rates is 0.2 on these cells. So that's a heck of a. You got to put a pretty solid refractory period on a Poisson process to try to get down to 0.2 for your CV. So, anyway, so just finishing up, acknowledging. So this work was mostly due to my postdoc, Dmitry Fisher, with some consulting help from my other postdoc, Sikpin Lim. And the early work on this was actually due to my former postdoc at Sazo, Ola Sagasti, who is now in Zurich. The experiments were from David Tank's lab, Emery Oxai, who's now at Cornell, Guy Major, and Bob Baker's lab at NYU. So thanks. Yep. Yep. So there is an ambiguity that we can't tell in the experiments of where the cut is between basically when you go and inactivate, basically there's a region between plus and minus 5 degrees of visual angle where you might have inhibition active as well. And it's difficult, and we can't really tell at that intersection whether there is a region where both inhibition and excitation would both be active, and it's just the data are too noisy to figure out exactly, is it exactly overlapping. But it's very interesting. You inactivate, I mean, it gets into readout issues, but you inactivate the left side of the animal's brain, and basically they continue to move their eyes just like they have a perfectly normal integrator when the eyes are to the right, and when the eyes are to the left, there's decay and it's clearly not integrating, and you see the parallel of that in the neurons. So the eyes basically probably are your best idea of what the average of all the neurons are doing. And it looks like that divide is pretty close to 0 degrees, but we can't really tell. So it's pretty interesting of how does it do the stitching right at zero. You know, is it that it's using both inhibition and excitation right around zero? I don't know. So how it stitches it together right near there? Great question. We're curious about it ourselves, but I can't answer it.
Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you won't make a prediction about the gains you will find in the circuit, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, you're testing it. So you're going back to the ability of the three. You won't make a prediction now where you say, look, neuron A will have a driver, neuron B with this kind of probability, and this kind of strength, and whatever. So to what extent are you going to really validate something that you want?
Yep. So at this stage, it is, I mean, what I've shown you is the bulk majority of it, and it's more just we remove a subset of cells and see what those other cells do, and you see the decay. So basically this is what Emery Oxey is working on. They're hard experiments, but that's what he's working on. And what he has done, which has advantages and disadvantages, so the goldfish was a beautiful system. We thought this was going to be the one. Turns out it's quite, because it's very thickly myelinated, it's really hard to get down there. You're doing everything blind. They're doing these experiments in vivo because you have to figure out first that you're in, because there's these other cells in the area, you first have to know that you're in one of these integrator cells, which means you have to do it in vivo. Anyway, so what they've now switched to is a transgenic larval zebrafish, where they can use the power of genetics, and it's a pigmentless one, so you can actually image through the animal. So that's the direction they're moving. The only problem right now is the clarity of the imaging is clearest when the animals are quite young and in more developmental stages, so we don't yet know whether we're studying a developing circuit and how far along towards the mature circuit, and they're working on that. But once we do that, all of these sort of stimulate one neuron, measure the responses in the other neurons, and start getting those. And we're also working with Sebastian Sung to go and do the serial EM reconstruction. Yeah, so there's multiple levels of answer. It's a great question. So one thing is that these psychotic bursts are very, very strong and brief. So one thing is, okay, so you have something slow and you slam it. You know, and that's part of the reason and that's part of how you kick it up. Now, in terms of exactly how strong that kick should be, there's beautiful work from the group of Al Fuchs at University of Washington showing that the cerebellum is involved in tuning the exact strength of that input. So you can basically fool animals that when they're making a saccade of a certain distance, basically while they're making the saccade, you move what they were making a saccade to over, and you keep on, and it basically will learn to send stronger saccadic kicks in. So it's actually doing the wrong thing in the natural world, but the right thing in the virtual environment you trick them with. So one answer is there are pathways to do that, but then there's just this simple question of how did you build a slow circuit and have it respond quickly. I think part of the answer could be related to these bistable processes. So these bistable processes that can have a long time scale, there's two features of them. One, they're slow, but it's not slow in the sense of it's your linear filter with a slow linear filter. What bistable processes do is when you get an input, they have a rapid onset, and then they stay up for a long time. So I think that nonlinearity of having the rapid onset and then the rapid offset may be very important in amplifying these inputs. And that was the other thing I liked about this as part of the original theoretical paper on this. Yeah, so in the models, where that comes from is different time scales between the different types of inputs. So that we have that's another thing, is the recurrent connections are slow, but the external connections are fast.
Okay.
And that's fundamentally where it comes from. Yeah.
Other questions?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.